let's think of finance for today. First order of business is to approve the minutes. Representative Green?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from February 8th.
Okay, Representative Green moves the minutes. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Minutes are approved. First on the dock today, we've got Secretary of State. You're already there. Secretary Simon, how are you this afternoon?
I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. We'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you, members, and Mr. Chair. I really appreciate it. I know you have a full docket, full schedule today. I'm only first of, I think, three large agencies, so I'll try to be quick. Just give me the hook if I'm going too long. I want to thank the committee for having me here today. It's a pleasure to be here for a number of reasons, one of which is that I served on this committee for many years, the majority of the time that I was in the Minnesota House, and I served alongside some of you, so it's great to be back. It's sort of like a homecoming. Second, I really appreciate this committee's approach this year to going about the budget-making process. I say that because, and I don't know whether other committees are doing this, but I really appreciate the joint or dual approach that this committee is following, working alongside with your Senate counterpart, and particularly Chair Kiffmeyer, in doing joint requests for information. I don't know, again, if that's policy now and all committees are doing that, but whether they are or aren't, I really appreciate it. I know our office does. It really makes sure we all have a common set of facts. So we've given you a lot of information in response to the global or comprehensive letter to the Senate as well. You have your budget books, no doubt, in front of you. But what I wanted to do today was go a little bit beyond that. I just didn't want to repeat what you already have in front of you, although some of it overlaps a little bit. I wanted to provide a little extra context or flavor or value so you have some understanding of the office, particularly as it pertains to the budget. Some of you who are on the policy committee, Representative O'Driscoll's committee, have seen some of this but not all of this before, so there may be some overlap, but it probably bears repeating. I wanted to start by making this clear. Let's see here. Here we go. Oops. Okay. So here we go. So I want to start here because it's an important point, members. We are a net contributor and a big one to the general fund. And I say that because some of you know from experience here that that is rarely the case. My recollection is that there are only a couple state agencies. The Department of Commerce comes to mind, I believe, that is one. There are some other smaller agencies, perhaps. But there are very few state agencies that can say that, we actually make money for the state. So when you back out everything, when you back out our budget and costs, both indirect and direct, the bottom line net to the state is $20 million per biennium, $10 million per year. And I think that's something worth noting. We're proud of that, and that's the role that you and the legislature, going back decades, have always contemplated for us. So that's not an accident. I want to say in terms of the numbers, this isn't on your slide, but you may notice in your budget base, we are not asking for a penny more than the adjusted base, not one penny. So we're just asking for what's already more or less automatically allocated by the formulas that exist. We're not asking for any more money, for any more initiatives or anything like that. The extent there is new stuff, we're going to absorb that and have to figure it out internally with whatever you give us at the end of the day. There is one change amount that you will notice in your budget packets. I'll explain that in a subsequent slide. It has to do with an initiative that others are supporting that we support as well for elections equipment. It's being housed in our budget, so it has the appearance of a budget increase for us, but it's not in the sense that we won't keep any of that money. We'll be the custodian, more or less, and it's sort of a pass-through account, but I'll explain that in a minute. But in terms of what we get to spend, we're not proposing one penny more. The overwhelming percentage of the money in our office is for two things, salaries and IT. Salaries, that's for most state agencies, but IT is another particular component. I know, Mr. Chair, you take a particular interest in this, and we've had some conversations both in hearings and offline about this as well. It's a huge component of what we do in our office, not just salary-wise, but in terms of the software, the coding, everything else. So that's where the money goes, basically. And I would point out as well, again, not on your slide, we're unique among state constitutional offices. We are a highly transactional office. This isn't to unfavorably contrast the others, the state auditor, the attorney general's office, or the governor's office, but our website gets over a million unique visitors per year. Not hits. It's many more than a million hits. 1 million unique IP addresses per year, and that's because unlike those other offices, equally worthy, of course, but we actually transact business. And what we do is engage consumers, business owners in actual transactions that happen online. So people come to our website not just to see what the office is all about, because they're actually transacting business. So this is the pie chart that tells you a little bit about sort of division of labor in terms of staffing. And as you can see, and some of you know, by far the biggest area of our office in terms of FTEs is business services. It's not elections. Even though when and if Minnesotans think about our office, they probably think of the elections function. That's where the spotlight tends to find the office, not the other way around. But really, it's the business services function that has the lion's share of the workforce. And that work goes on in a separate location. Many of you know our main administrative and elections office is upstairs on the first floor of this building, in the state office building. But the business services functions are housed in a building about 8 blocks away on Empire Drive. So a long walk down Rice Street, basically. And that's where those folks are housed. Followed by elections upstairs and administration, and then the Safe at Home program, which I'll describe later. In terms of total FTE count, according to the MMB reporting requirements as of last July 1st, it was 79.4. Just to let you know, even next year, we will be at 2002-2003 levels. And to give you some history, the recent high for this office, going back the last decade, decade and a half, was, I think, in 2010, we were at, and this was before my time in the office, we were at 111.6 FTEs, 111.6. Right now we're at 79.4. Historical spending. This is actually in your budget packet, but it seemed appropriate to also add here. It's the one piece of overlap. You can cruise this on your own, I suppose, but you'll see payroll is a big part. Operating expenses for us, that's a big chunk as well. And for us, because of the IT-heavy nature of what we do, it's stuff like servers and the hardware and the software and the other things there. And then you can see the historic spending. And I think the key thing to look at there is that bottom or blue bar, which is the general fund spending. And you'll see across the last decade or more, it's pretty much flat, and we want it to remain flat. So we're not asking for any more money out of the general fund. And it's been flat for a long time. Just a little bit about business services. We like to think of this as sort of the welcome mat for Minnesota businesses. Hundreds of thousands of business entities of all sizes and types in Minnesota have to file stuff with our office, both initially and then thereafter, typically annually, and when they amend articles of incorporation and do other various business transactions. We call ourselves the welcome mat because very often, as some of you know from your private sector experience, before an entity will do almost anything else, meaning get a tax ID number, get licenses or permits, get workers' comp insurance if that's even required, they will, of course, form the actual entity. And so we are very often the very first thing, the very first office that businesses of all kinds interact with. So we do things, as you can see in the slide, like approve and file articles of incorporation. We have services provided both online and on a walk-in basis, and we do all manner of those kinds of basic business transactions. The other thing that we do on the next slide has to do with the UCC division within business services. UCC, of course, is the Uniform Commercial Code, and there's where, apart from our role in helping businesses to come online, this is where we are sort of part of helping the wheels of commerce go round and round, because there are a lot of commercial, there's a lot of commercial paper, basically, a lot of transaction-based documents that are filed with our office and that we have to keep track of to make sure that businesses can go on. We administer something called the CNS system, Central Notification System, for farm product liens, so we deal a lot with farm groups and the agricultural economy, and we have regular meetings both in the office and throughout the state with those folks, and we also file and maintain statewide federal tax liens as well. So a lot of people are depending on our office for the wheels of commerce to go around. Just a few statistics, members, just so you kind of understand the scope here. We had our second highest ever annual total on record for new business filings. So in 2016, the year just ended, about 62,501 new business filings. Total business filings in 2016, not quite a record, but also close, over 400,000. And if you're doing the back of the napkin math, that's one business entity for roughly every 13 Minnesotans. Some are huge businesses that we've all heard of. Some are mom and pops. Some are sole proprietorships that you would never have heard of. Or they're hobby businesses. They're maybe not full-time. I always give the example of my sister's wedding cake business. You know, a few years ago she had one. It wasn't her main gig, but on the side she had a wedding cake business. I know because I helped her load more than a few wedding cakes into an SUV for a reception. So it can be all sorts of different businesses like that. Now, elections administration, I think, Mr. Chair, it's fair to say, is what most people probably associate with our office if and when they think of our office, certainly among the general public. And sometimes people will say to me or say to us, oh, the Office of Secretary of State, you're the ones who run the election system. And I think that is unintentionally a comment that ignores the role, the vital role, and the significant role of counties, cities, and townships. They're the ones who really run the election system. We don't own any elections equipment. We don't train any election judges. We don't count the actual ballots. They do all that work. And it takes an army, for example, of over 32,000 election judges to run an election in the state. Just think about that, 32,000 people plus. And we don't recruit any of them. That's all folks at your local level. That's the counties, that's the cities, that's the townships. So they do that great frontline work. What we do, though, you'll see in the slide, is we operate the SVRS, the Statewide Voter Registration System. That's the big sort of database of all voters. We certify voting systems. That's a core function. You know, in the last committee, those of you who were on the committee, I got a question, and I'll just preempt it here by saying if any of you, it's open to the public anyway, but if any of you ever want notice, particular notice about that process, we do it here in the state office building. It typically takes a couple of days where a vendor will come in seeking certification to a certain standard so that they can sell the product in Minnesota. We typically reserve a room like 300 north or south, something like that, for a couple days, and we put the machine through the paces, the election staff, by putting all sorts of, you know, tricky information in there, intentional overvotes or undervotes and things like that, and put it through the paces. So we do that. We also, as you know from personal experience, we accept candidate filings. We train the trainers. We don't train election judges, but we train the people who train the election judges. And then we conduct most recounts. I say most because some of you already know this, but it bears repeating. We only conduct recounts that straddle a county line. And if it's all within a county, we don't have any role. So I'll give you a very real-world example. Many of you know that this election cycle just concluded. There were two state Senate recounts. One was in Senate District 14 in the St. Cloud area. That straddled three counties, and we were very much involved. A second one was in Senate District 44. Chair Anderson, who's not here, that's her Senate district, where there was a recount for the state Senate. We had no role in that because that's Plymouth and Minnetonka area, and it's entirely within Hennepin County. So there was no role for our office whatsoever in the actual recount. In terms of some of the numbers, and some of you are familiar with some of this, we had a record number of registered voters, north of 3.2 million, a record number of actual voters, just shy, painfully shy, of 3 million, almost got there, 2,968,000 and change. And this next number is amazing and a real game changer, I think. And many of you are aware of it because you helped craft the laws that make this happen. We had a record 678,000 people who voted on a day that was not election day. Now, just to put this statistic in context, it's almost 23% of the electorate. So creeping up on a quarter of people have already voted by election day. To give you some perspective, though it's not on the slide, the typical percentage in typical years of how many people vote before election day is typically high single digits, very low double digits, 8, 9, 10, maybe 11%. Here, it's double that previous high. It's over 22%, almost 23%. And that tells me that the laws that you have passed in recent years, people like, and that they're voting with their feet, and they like the freedom and flexibility of voting at a time that's not that first Tuesday in November between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. I mentioned the election judge statistic before. That always just blows me away. I mean, that's a lot of people. That is a small army to administer elections. And, of course, I would be remiss if I didn't remind everyone that we got back to number one. That was our big goal as a state this year. We'd always been towards or at the top of the list, but we slipped a little in recent years. In 2014, we were sixth in the country, not bad at all. If you're grading on a curve, 6 out of 50, very decent, but not quite up to our usual high Minnesota standards. So a lot of people work really hard to get us back to number one, and we were. And in case you want to rub it into your friends in New Hampshire, they were number two. And if you have friends in Oregon, they took the bronze medal at number three.
And Mr. Secretary, if you could just remind me, what county came in number one for voter turnout? I forget sometimes.
Let's see. It might be Carver County.
I believe it was at 83.6%.
That's right.
But who's bragging?
That's right. Exactly. Well, you deserve to brag, Mr. Chair.
I had nothing to do with it. I voted just once.
I want to talk briefly here because it does pertain directly to the budget about elections equipment here. This is a huge issue. National federal sources say that there are 43 states in the same boat as Minnesota, and we don't own any. So this isn't about our office. We don't own one piece of elections equipment in our office. It's all owned and operated by folks at the local level. But just a quick bit of history, and many of you are well familiar with it. In 2002, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA for short. and it was a response in large part to Florida in the year 2000. Not a response to the outcome, but the procedure. Everyone seemed to agree, whether they were for Bush or Gore or Ralph Nader or someone else, that Florida 2000 was not our best moment as a democracy, that from an elections administration standpoint, no matter who you were for, it was a real mess. So Congress, with broad bipartisan support, passed HAVA, which, among other things, wrote a giant check to buy America new elections equipment. Everybody in America. So our share of the money came down the pike shortly thereafter, and most elections administrators in Minnesota bought their equipment in the 04, 05, 06 range, maybe 07. Well, the vendors then and now will tell you, you're looking at 10-year life expectancy, 15 absolute max, depending on wear and tear. And the problem is, Congress in recent years, under both parties, by the way, has made clear that HAVA was a one-time deal. That was not clear when HAVA was passed at all. Now it has been made clear. So I think local elections administrators have a good story to tell. And the story is, here is a mandatory function. It's not like a park or a trail or something else a local government can choose to kick down the can down the road on. Mandatory function, using outdated and aging equipment, for which vendors are saying they might stop supplying parts soon. It's sort of like trying to get a part for your 2003-2004 era cell phone. You know, you might be able to do it. You might be able to go online and go on eBay or something, but, you know, it's hard. You could get it repaired, but it would be hard. So mandatory function, aging stuff, expensive to replace, about $10,000 per polling place, typically to replace the two pieces of equipment that everyone has to have, the ballot counter that you feed it into, and then the assistive voting technology, which HAVA required for every precinct in America, which is the AutoMark or other machine that allows voters with disabilities to vote. It's expensive stuff. So the cost to replace everything, if the state were to help out and buy everyone everything, it would be $28 million. No one's asking that the state offer buy everything for everyone. But the governor's but I and others, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and other ones leading this effort, we support it, but they're leading it, are really asking for your help in getting some support to local governments, some reasonable match, so that local governments have some skin in the game. Of course, you shouldn't have it all purchased for them, but some skin in the game and some help. And this is, by the way, an issue more in greater Minnesota than the metro area. Hennepin County has bought nearly all of its stuff. Ramsey has bought all of its new stuff. So has Dakota and Anoka. It's not about the metro area. It's mostly about greater Minnesota and places without either the budgets or the tax capacity in some cases to buy this stuff, at least easily, without it hurting. And so the governor has proposed in his budget basically a 50-50 split, that over 4 years, so it's gradual, out of that $28 million, $14 million, $7 million this biennium and $7 million in the out biennium would go for this purpose. And this comes back to the first thing I said, members, which is that this shows up on our budget as a requested increase, even though we don't get any money for it. So it has to be housed somewhere. There has to be a state account housed somewhere. It's just a pass-through. If this were to be housed, as the governor proposes, in our office, we wouldn't get one penny of it, even for administering the program. And frankly, it could be housed anywhere. It could be housed in the Department of Administration. It could be housed anywhere you choose. I care less that it be where it's housed than I care that it gets done and that folks at the local level get some aid. So I just ask for your consideration on that point. I think it's a big issue. And let me just say this. You all know from your service here, whether it's a few weeks or a few years, people, especially at funding time, tend to use the word crisis a lot when they're asking for money. And I don't want to cry wolf by doing that. I can't sit here and tell you right now, today, there's a crisis with elections equipment. But what I can say is if we don't, as the saying says, dig our wells before we're thirsty, if we wait till the 2018 election, certainly the 2020 election, if we don't get out ahead of us, we're really flirting with some failures and shutdowns and difficulties, and I don't think we want to go there. I don't think we want a Florida-like situation in 2000, where from an administrative standpoint, we start having some real holes and real problems. So I just want to be kind of honest about that, and I'm sure other people will talk to you about this issue as well. Quickly, members, because I know you're pressed for time, in the administration area of the office, which is that 4% sliver that you saw a piece of pie on the first page, that's basically administering the open appointments process. Some of you know that there are about 220-plus boards and commissions. We don't make any of the appointments at all. All we do is administer the intake process. You can go online and find out more about that. We certify official documents. We have a role in the legislative process, sign all the bills that are ultimately enrolled. And then there's service on these boards, the Executive Council, the State Board of Investment, and the Historical Society, and that's all by statute. The Safe at Home program, some of you are familiar with, particularly gratifying for me. I worked with some of you in particular in this room on that over the years when I was alongside you. This is an address anonymity or address confidentiality program started by the legislature in 2006. It went online in 2007, and basically it allows people who are enrolled, typically victims of domestic violence, to keep their true physical address shielded and secret for all purposes, public and private. So it's not just in dealing with the school district for enrolling a kid in school. It could also be dealing with the cable company or the utility company. And we were one of the first three states to do it. Now 30-some states have done it. And we do things like repackage and reforward their mail so that no one knows where they really live. We partner with social service agencies, law enforcement, counties. And this last point is interesting. It's sort of a bittersweet statistic. We started out years ago with 200 participants. Now it's 2,300. I mean, I don't know what to say about that. It's not necessarily something to celebrate. It is in the sense that this service exists and people are taking advantage of that security umbrella, something that they tell us has been life-saving and life-changing. And it's particularly gratifying for all of us who touch it and deal with it. On the other hand, is it really something to cheer that 2,311 people need this service? I would like nothing more than to work myself out of a job when it comes to Safe at Home, as we all would. But there it is. And if you look on the next page, this is just a map, which is to say that we are now finally, as of the end of last year, covered every single county plus two tribal jurisdictions for a total of 89 geographical areas that are served by Safe at Home that have someone in that jurisdiction who is a so-called application assistant, someone who can counsel victims of domestic violence and others about whether this is or is not appropriate. And for some people, it's not appropriate at all. For some, it is, and we don't make that call in our office. That's the call of people who counsel victims of domestic violence. Here you'll see again, sort of a bittersweet kind of chart here. It's good that people are taking advantage of the service and that they can avail themselves of the resources. Not so good that we need it. And here you can read on your own or just some testimonials that have come in recently about the program. Again, it's something that makes everyone who touches it feel really good about the work they do. The last slide is just to leave you where I started, which is just the reminder that unlike the vast majority of federal agencies and offices, we're a net contributor to the general fund, net $20 million when you back everything out. And so I'm happy to stand for questions. I also realize, as a function of time, not everyone can always ask questions, nor do questions necessarily occur at the hearing. They might occur afterwards, as I've told many of you in face-to-face meetings and will continue to do. If you ever have questions about the budget or other things pertaining to our office, I'm always happy to meet with you, as is our staff, or you can come upstairs, or you can send an email, or whatever. It doesn't have to be limited to this hearing. We're happy to follow up and give you as much information as you need and want. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Secretary. We do have some member questions, and I'm going to start off. I've got two quick ones. One, love the new webpage, and you said that a large portion of your budget does get allocated for IT services, so if you could quickly just kind of run through how you're doing that, how you're procuring IT services, and the process that you go through.
Yeah, it's huge. And I have to say, sometimes I get asked, just by, even by friends and family, oh, what's the biggest surprise since you've been in this office? It's been 2 years now. And I always say without hesitation, the biggest surprise for me is the extent to which the job really requires keeping a close eye on IT and particularly cybersecurity issues. It's not something that typically comes up in, frankly, candidate debates or questionnaires from interest groups and other things, but it's a big part of the job. And so we take it very seriously. I take it very seriously. In terms of procurement of the services, we do not, Mr. Chair, as I know you've taken a personal interest in, our use of MNIT is limited. We use them as, you know, the Internet service provider services, but we do the vast majority of what we do in-house, and there's a reason for that. We are an independent, you know, constitutional officer, independently elected and independent constitutional officer. We're not under the executive branch, really. We're not a department of X, Y, or Z. They're just as worthy as we are. That's not to say it's exalted or special. I just mean it's different in kind. So we're not just another sort of department under the governor. We're separate and independent. And also the nature of the work that we do, which is very programming heavy, very specific, not stuff you can get off the shelf. It requires a long-term investment of obviously money, but also people. And so it just wouldn't work for our office to have people who are there for 3 months on a contract basis, working on a job, and then moving on. We need to build that institutional memory and knowledge, and we do have it, which is great. So that's one of the reasons that we use MNIT sparingly. We use them for bare basics kind of things, but we really have the in-house operation. And that's where the money, that's, I mean, as I said at the outset, you look at the pie charts, you look at the numbers, that's where the money goes.
And Mr. Secretary, when you and Ms. Strother came by my office, we had chatted about maybe looking at how you allocate that and look at your costs, and then I'd like to use that as a benchmark against some of the other stuff that we do for Minute, and would love to set up a time for you to come by or me come down to you and and chat through that. And then the second is to give you some kudos. Almost every other agency is asking for greater appropriations than previous years. I think you should share your secret with everybody so that we can understand, you know, what is it you're doing that they're not, or vice versa. Would love to know how it is that you're not asking for more.
Well, Mr. Chair, we try to be, the only thing I can say is we try to be cautious. We try to, in essence, live with what you give us. And if there's something that we can't do, we either don't do it or we do less with something else. And there are concrete examples we've had just in the 2 years since I've been in office. One big one I'm thinking of where we thought we just can't do that. It doesn't make sense to do that because we'd rather do some other thing. You just have to make those choices. And I understand that it's easy for me to say that. I'm not in those other offices, and it may not be as easy to make those kinds of decisions in other offices. But we've tried, as you've seen, to make sure that the general fund allocation across the years has been pretty flat, and we want to try to continue that as well.
We've got some member questions. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Secretary Simon. Don't you miss being here?
Part of me does, Madam Chair. Yes.
At least you didn't go to the Senate. we've had this conversation, and I think that you gave me some answers to the questions that we asked when we had our conversation in my office. I did have one question, though, on the transfers piece, the chargeback. Does that also include any chargebacks that you have from other constitutional offices? Is that, do you have any of that? I see that you don't have it here, so I'm just asking, do you have any chargebacks from any of the other constitutional offices?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, a chargeback from in the letter that we gave to your office, we have the full listing, and I don't recall any. If it's not on the list, then it probably isn't there. And most of those chargebacks, they're pretty modest. The big one you'll see, I'm just going from memory here, was from the Department of Revenue, and that has to do with tax lien filing fees. I mentioned earlier in the presentation, we do a lot of, by way of tax liens, so that's a big part of that as well. It's in essence fees that other agencies pay to us. Because they are in the shoes of other businesses. They're filing things, too, just like a business would. In the case of Department of Revenue, it's tax liens. But in others, they're small. You'll see very small amounts. Sometimes I think a couple of the line items were in the hundreds of dollars, very small chargebacks. And they're just that. They're fees that we would ordinarily charge anyone else, whether it's a state agency or a business, or they just happen to be a state agency. But it's categorized by MMB as a chargeback because it comes from a state agency.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Anderson, anything? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hello, Mr. Secretary. A couple questions. One has to do with election judges in the district that I represent. It seems like we're having difficulty getting sufficient election judges, and it's mainly elderly women who look like they're kind of winding down in terms of their ability to volunteer and provide service. Do you have any thoughts or suggestions on how we can help increase the pool of election judges as we move forward?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Johnson. A couple things that we've talked with local administrators about with election judges. It's always something that people are a little nervous about, making sure we keep retaining and replenishing that pool of election judges, as you saw, almost 32,000 throughout the state. There are a couple things that some jurisdictions have tried with some success. One is to aim younger, particularly at student populations. High school students in Minnesota, 17-year-olds, you don't even have to be eligible to vote to serve in a polling place as an assistant to an election judge to help sort of take some of the work off of those who are election judges. High school students, college students. And then the other thing that I'm intrigued by is the use of community organizations So whether it's a Kiwanis Club or a Rotary Club, it can even be used potentially as a fundraising mechanism for that organization. A Rotary Club might say to its members, hey, let's try, can we have two or three volunteers here to do a half shift or a whole shift at a polling place? And maybe it's even the case that they donate part or all of the stipend that they get to the organization. So it can be a way not only to give back to the communities, but to get a little money in the door for a particular civic organization. So that's one thing as well. I will just say, too, I know this isn't the policy committee, Mr. Chair, but one thing that I do hear from elections administrators around the state, and we have 3 years to think about this, is with the new presidential primary that will come online in 2020 that those of you who were here last time passed, there is some nervousness by some elections administrators, particularly but not only in greater Minnesota, about having that third election per year, though only once every 4 years, particularly the fact that it will happen in the winter, and they're worried about snowbirds. They might have an election judge who's a retiree, who goes away for the winter, maybe goes away after Thanksgiving, comes back in the spring. Maybe they're not going to be around for that wintertime election. And so even though it's 3 years away, there's some thought about that. I know we're not going to solve that issue today, here and now, but that's one related issue in terms of just people power and making sure we have enough people, enough of the 32,000 to make elections go well.
Well, fortunately, we do have the policy chair with us, so
we do.
Message received. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just on the electronic election systems, that seems like a huge deal. It is a huge deal, obviously. Are there any examples of system failures in Minnesota or other states as far as that matter goes? And I'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes, there are some examples. They are anecdotal. I can't say we've done a broad survey since the last election, but I have heard personally from elections administrators about failures of equipment, particularly the ballot counter, and usually that's solvable or fixable on the spot. Sometimes administrators will have an extra machine that they can substitute in, and it's worked that way. But I think over time, that's going to become more of a problem. And as I say, the vendors themselves say 10 years, maybe 15 at the absolute max, and we're getting to the point where they're going to stop servicing some of the equipment and some of the parts. So it is a concern, and I would just hope that we could all get ahead of this problem on that score. Other states have different kinds of equipment that we do. One of the things that's, I think, relevant to this debate and where Minnesota is in very, very good shape, many of you know we've had a broad, longstanding, ultra-bipartisan position in this state, regardless of who's in charge, of always wanting paper trails. So our equipment in Minnesota must have a paper trail. We still vote pen to paper, which is great. You can't hack paper. And you feed it into the ballot counter, of course, but under our state law, that ballot counter must not, shall not, may not be connected to the Internet. And so that's great. In some states, though, when their HAVA money came in a decade or decade and a half ago, they were sold on this vision of the paperless future. How many times have we all heard that? You know, we're going to all live in these glorious paperless offices. And they were sold by that vision, apparently. And there were a number of states, including some battleground states in the last presidential election, who bought all new elections equipment, but it was all paperless with no paper trail, no paper receipt, nothing. And I think from a security standpoint, they were quite nervous this past fall. We don't do that in Minnesota, which is good. So from that standpoint, I don't know what the breakdown rate is of those machines that are only touchscreen. I would imagine it's much higher. So we're blessed by keeping it simple here in Minnesota. And I think, you know, our old-school approach of pen to paper and always, always, always having a paper trail, even if we have electronic stuff, I think that has served us well. That's been a bedrock principle across party lines and across control and across decades in Minnesota.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And lastly, the AutoMark systems, I know they aren't used a lot, but you still think they need to be replaced given their minimal use? Why is that?
That's a great
Mr.
point.
Secretary.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the AutoMark is really the trade name for the assisted, for one vendor's model of the assisted voting technology. It's become a commonplace term because it's got huge market share in Minnesota, but that may be changing. I mean, nothing against that particular vendor, but when HAVA first came and people were buying that equipment, they were the only game in town. They were literally the only vendor certified. They had, you know, basically monopoly status. Now our office over the years and recently has certified multiple vendors for that replacement assistive voting technology equipment, which means there will be price competition, which is good for those buying this equipment. There won't just be one vendor anymore who can set a price. There will be three or more vendors. And the machines if you've seen them, they are much slimmer, sleeker, lighter, just better overall than the equipment that existed. But to your point, they aren't in many places often used. They are federally mandated, so we couldn't change that here in the state if we wanted to. But they're federally mandated that there be an assistive voting technology machine in every precinct in America. But what the elections administrators tell me is even though a lot of people don't use them in a lot of places, that interestingly, you can see wear and tear from these machines as much from underuse as from overuse. And the example they use with that, now this is really getting into the weeds, but it answers a question, which is that one of the things that this machine, and this is 2002-2003 technology, has is it has an ink pad in it. Like an actual ink pad, like think about the ink stamp that you use, kind of the old school ink stamps. Well, of course that's going to dry and crack over a decade or decade and a half. I mean, it's those kinds of things we're talking about. The new machines, all of them, don't have that kind of technology. It's much more advanced and sleeker and slimmer and lighter and hopefully cheaper. Still expensive, but cheaper because you'll have price competition.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Secretary.
Representative Udlum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, again, congratulations on your great budget and contribution to the general fund. I think that's just wonderful. My question is a little bit about the absentee ballots and the mail ballots. Question is, the increased cost for your organization to cover that. And then the second part of the question is, of course, these are not coming out of a typical voter precinct. So what about the election judge thing? And that's not in there, I assume. So could you enlighten me a little bit?
Mr. Secretary.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Udlum. So I would say that in terms of the cost, it is true that absentee voting can be more expensive, and all the local elections administrators will tell you that. But there are compensating advantages as well. For example, less traffic and stress and hassle in the voting place on election day. When you see 678,000 people voting, you know, one way to look at that is that's 678,000 people not waiting in line on election day and not sort of challenging a lot of the election judges who are there. So it's there are sort of competing values there. Overall, what elections administrators, I think, could use, at least they tell me that, and I'm sure some have talked to you. I know Mako Day on the Hill was the other day, the county officers, many of whom were elections administrators, so you may have met with some from your districts. But what they would tell you is what would sure would help them are things like extending the current one-week period that we have of absentee balloting where you don't need the envelopes. There's a lot of extra time, hassle, and expense in having the envelopes. And you, the legislature, last session passed a law saying that for that 1 week of in-person absentee voting before the election, you don't need the envelopes anymore. The old system was you had to put your ballot in an envelope, put that envelope inside another envelope, then hand it to someone behind the counter. You said last time it was a good move, they love it, which is, no, for that week before, you don't have to do the envelope business. You can feed it right into the ballot counter. I think what they'd like to see, and Representative Fenton has the bill to that effect, is an extension, even perhaps a significant extension of that period. That would save a lot of money, for sure, and also time and hassle. And I think, based on the reports I've heard, that circumstance is good for the people on both sides of the counter. Voters loved it because who wants to come in and mess around with a bunch of envelopes? And the administrators loved it because, well, who wants to mess around with a bunch of envelopes? So it really is a win-win for that reason. And I know Representative Fenton might be talking to you more about that because that's their bill.
Representative Eveline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the second part of my question is in terms of when we're doing this early voting and things, election judges aren't present, what's the safeguard?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Udlum. Well, that's a long answer to that question. I would say there are a number of safeguards in place that we've had here for the last 40-plus years in Minnesota, regardless of who's in charge, regardless of who's held this office, regardless of who's been in the legislature, starting with the fact that with registration and absentee voting, particularly people who are unregistered and vote absentee and register when they're voting absentee, the rule in Minnesota has been pretty bedrock. It's gone through some changes over the years, but the rule is that you've got to show two things. You are who you say you are, and you live where you say you live. That's the two things. Now, our laws have been pretty flexible on how you can do that. It can be, and mostly is, people using an ID, a government ID, typically a driver's license. But as many of you know from experience, it can be other things as well. It can be combinations of things that include a utility bill. It can be, vouching by somebody in your precinct who swears under penalty of perjury that you are who you say you are and you live where you say you live, things like that. So that, I guess, without going too long and over time, I would say that's the threshold sort of determination there, which holds for someone, by the way, who votes either in person absentee, in other words, someone who goes to a government building and does it, or someone who decides, as many have, to just order the absentee ballot to their home. So that's a very brief answer to a question that we could spend a lot of time on, but that's what I would say to that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon. And I also wanted to thank your office for meeting yesterday and for follow through on the questions that I had. I really appreciate Ms. Struthers dropping by with all the answers to my questions. Appreciate that greatly. My question is with regard to the Safe at Home, and I'm wondering how Minnesota citizens learn about this program. And I'm assuming that it has something to do with the 80 social services that you are affiliated with, but if you could just expound upon that, please.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, yeah, that is an ongoing sort of challenge for us. We want people to know that this even exists. I think most people don't, clearly. And not so much for themselves necessarily, but for a coworker, a friend, a family member, just to know, yeah, there's a program out there that you can enroll in where your true physical address is secret. It's a good thing to know that it exists. We do rely heavily on these application assistants and these partners. Sometimes it's social service agencies. Sometimes it's law enforcement. I've had meetings even in the last 2 weeks, including in Carver County, Mr. Chair, with your county attorney, I think last week or the week before, where there's a role for county attorneys in this. Sometimes it's done through a battered women's shelter. Sometimes in some counties it's both, in counties that have that capacity. So spreading the word that this exists is important. And a lot of people just don't know about it, and we're always looking for ways to do that so that people know about it. We work with those nonprofit and law enforcement partners to do it. All I can say is, you know, the more the better. It's something we want people to know about so that they can take advantage of it if they or someone they know needs it. That's the best answer I can give.
Thank you.
We don't have a big marketing budget, I'll tell you that, or any, I think, for that. It's just a question of getting word out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, I was going to ask you where the expense was in your budget, but I haven't looked at that, but I don't probably need to do that because whatever it is, looks like you're working well within your budget to accommodate this. And sadly, I expect to continue to see this grow, but good job on this program.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, Ron, to the Secretary Simon, the $20 million net, and I'm curious, is that the net for the entire department? So, therefore, when you take all of the revenue and take out all the expenses for all of these different programs, that it's netting out to $10 million a year?
Mr. Secretary.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Vogel, yes, that's correct. That's the net.
Okay.
For everything. You back out everything we cost and everything we generate. And those fees, by the way, those base fees are set by you. Those base fees are set by you, not us. And some of those fees, by the way, have not been changed since the 80s or early 90s. We have not, in the last 2 years since I've been in the job, raised one fee, one penny. So those are set mostly in statute and have not been raised.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary Simon, you anticipated my question because what I'm wondering is what the control mechanism is, because what we're doing is obviously charging people more than the service cost for recording or whatever, and what type of mechanism do we have in place to make sure that there's maybe needs to be recommendations made to lower those fees, because it is nice to see a profit, if you will, or a net of income over expenses, but by the same token, those people are indirectly paying for a lot of other things when they buy a house and pay a mortgage registration. So wondering what kind of a mechanism we have to make sure that we're constantly monitoring that so that we're not overcharging relative to what people pay.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, that's a great question, and I'm very sensitive to that. I would put it this way. I would tweak a little bit what you say. I wouldn't say that it's more than the cost of providing the service. I would say that it is more than the cost of running the Secretary of State's office. In other words, one of the things that's in statute since the 80s, I believe, is the idea, and this has been a longstanding principle with respect to, I think, many agencies, but our office, but the legislature starting in the 80s said that we should, in that sense, operate like a business. We should charge a fee that bears some relation to the actual cost of what's provided, not just as some sort of profit center or generator. Now, it happens to be that we generate more money than we cost, but I don't think that's necessarily the same thing as saying we generate more money than is associated with the individual service. And part of that has to do with IT, the online services in particular. But, of course, you, the legislature, are free to change that. I mean, you're free to lower the fee. We can't do that. But if you wanted to do that and if you wanted to lower the fee, you could do that, clearly. And I just want to make sure everyone's clear. We don't keep that $20 million. That doesn't go to us. We don't profit from that, literally or figuratively, from the $20 million.
Just want Secretary, I didn't mean to imply that, obviously, that anybody was there keeping it. I guess what I'm thinking of is that if somebody is paying a mortgage registration tax on their house for a service, which is recording, but there is enough over and above all of those costs that are built into the recording fee that it's able to pay for all of the elections and the safe at home and all of that, that indirectly then they start paying for that. And just wondering if we're doing an analysis on that. It's nice to see another $10 million a year coming in, but by the same token, the cost of buying a home continues to escalate, and if we don't keep an eye on all of those fees, or whether it's incorporating a business, we're indirectly charging them, and I didn't know what the mechanism was, so I won't go into a lot of detail, but that maybe just offline we could chat about that or at least look at how that's being distributed so people aren't paying for something that everybody should be paying for. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, too, on the information that you provided us on the chargeback piece, I'm looking for more detail, so a column that says actually what this is going toward, in addition to the agency itself, so what you're paying in for what reason. So if you can, when you get a chance, if you can get that to us, I think that would be helpful, too. And then just going back to the issue on the election equipment, and hopefully this is in the information that you've given to staff here today. My concern is, I mean, we give county program aid to counties based upon their capability to pay or their financial means and so forth. And so in your conversations with the counties, have you had talks about are they – I know some counties are setting money aside and some are not. So for the future – are we having conversations about this is something that you probably need to plan for?
Yes.
And you as the secretary, have you kind of given them a picture of this is what you should expect, in a however 10-year process or so forth?
Mr. Secretary.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. Absolutely. And I think we might have had some conversation about that offline. I think this is a very special circumstance because the HAVA money went away unexpectedly. And a lot of local folks feel a little bit like they've been left holding the bag. But to your point, as I interpret your question, is, well, what about the next time? This isn't just going to be an ongoing 50-50 split, and what about 10 years from now? And I think, in my judgment, counties and townships and cities are on notice that for the next round, particularly if we do this year or this biennium or next biennium, that the state will be, frankly, less generous the next time because now you are on notice, as you weren't in this situation, and it's a peculiar kind of circumstance, but going forward, you will be on notice, and there will be an expectation that you cover far more, perhaps all, but far more of the cost. So I think that is an important distinction to make. They're really caught in a bind this time because the HAVA money went away, and I feel they can speak better for themselves than I can speak for them, but I think if they were sitting here, the sense of them would be they feel a little bit trapped by that, but in 10 or 15 years from now, that explanation won't be available to them. So I think it is important that counties and cities and towns for the next round do that kind of planning.
Chair Anderson?
And Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon, to that, how are you going to divvy up the grants then, too, if you were to get the money? We have a lot of different programs where it's, based upon need and, there's a prioritization of who gets first dibs, so to speak. So how would that work?
Mr. Secretary.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. We are working with a number of people, including Representative O'Driscoll, on the details there. I would say that we would want it to be as objective as opposed to subjective as possible. We don't want to be in the position in our office of picking winners and losers. There should be objective criteria about who gets the money, when, and first, and second, and so forth. And those are things that we've had discussions about. We don't want it to be discretionary. It wasn't discretionary for HAVA, although HAVA was different. That was just everybody gets everything. And it was federal money, and our office back 10, 15 years ago was the custodian and basically just doled it out. This might be a little bit different, but I agree with what I see embedded in your question, which is there have got to be some standards here, and I think there will be. The bill isn't done yet, but I think there will be standards, and any and all of you are free to let us know what you think they ought to be or amend the bill as introduced, but I think that's very, very important.
Yeah. Members, we've got four member questions, and in the interest of time, we're going to be moving on. Chair O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of the schedule and the work ahead of us, I will waive.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps Secretary Simon could give us an answer later if that's not convenient. I was also interested in what Representative Anderson asked about how this was going to be distributed. And along that line, what are our local units of government looking at in terms of the cost that they will incur whether or not they get part of this $7 million?
Mr. Secretary.
14.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, a sort of shorthand way to think about the cost, give or take, big asterisk, is you're probably talking about $10,000 per polling place, roughly. Could be a little less, could be a little bit more, but that's a good rule of thumb, about $10,000 per polling place. So you just multiply that by the number of polling places. Now, there's some places where there aren't that many, either because of population patterns or because in some jurisdictions, some smaller jurisdictions have chosen, because they're eligible to go to vote by mail only. I think about Lake of the Woods County, for example. Lake of the Woods County has 17 precincts in the entire county, but only two polling places in the city of Baudette. The rest of the county is vote by mail only. There is no elections equipment. So that's one perhaps extreme example, but it depends on the place.
Thank you.
Representative Ward?
Okay.
Representative Dittmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Secretary Simon. Could you give us just a brief update on how the new reforms for military voting overseas voters for men and women serving in the armed forces?
Mr.
Yes.
Secretary.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dittmer. I will say this. The numbers have yet to be crunched from the feds, and the Pentagon and others do this number crunching, and we won't have it for a while in terms of how many ballots were ordered, how many were filled out by military or other personnel, the so-called UOCAVA voters, which is an acronym that basically means military and overseas voters. It can be, you know, exchange students or business people or diplomats or missionaries, but it's mostly military. But we hope it's good. In the end, the Pentagon's going to give us the final number. The one thing I would say that we're very proud of, though, is that our office, because you gave us the statutory authority to do this, we added to the list of IDs that could serve the purpose of helping someone register to vote, we added the veteran's ID card. That had not been on the magic list before, the list that includes the driver's license or the state ID card. So we included it because it has all the security features that you would expect. It's been validated elsewhere. And that affects over 100,000 people in Minnesota who could potentially use that. And anecdotally, I haven't seen the final numbers, but anecdotally, I think that was a huge help to a lot of veteran service member families as well.
Representative Dittmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Secretary Simon, do we expect to see the results of this in the short term?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dittmer, I think so, and I can't recall offhand when their final report is going to be. I know we've submitted a lot of information to them, as have all the 50 states. I just can't recall offhand when that report will come
out.
But
thank you. Thank you.
Okay, last question for the Secretary, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, going back to Representative Vogel's inquiry on mortgage registration tax, I don't think that goes to the Secretary of State's office. And just wanted to clarify that. I think the county collects and it goes to the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Secretary?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think I took you to be speaking sort of metaphorically about a tax like that, that's a registration kind of thing. And we do a lot of, you know, mostly business registrations, but I think the same principle applies.
Is that what you're doing? Thank you, Mr.
Representative Johnson.
That's fine.
Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for being here, and I appreciate the fact that you're always available to us to stop by and ask questions. So, members, if you do have other questions, I know the Secretary is more than happy to do so. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, next we have Office of Administrative Hearings, Judge Proust. If you would, introduce yourself.
Absolutely. My name is Tammy Proust. I'm the Chief Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for having me here today, and I will try and get my laptop hipped up while we are starting our discussion. You have in your packet from my office, a double-sided colored sheet that's got a bunch of facts on both sides. You don't have a copy of my PowerPoint, but I can promise you there's not going to be anything in my PowerPoint that's not on the other handout. And so you have that, as you have that, and you have some of our financial information as well, including a copy of our organizational chart. You also have a corrected, just so that you know what you will find in your packet, there's a two-page document called Internal Service Fund Financial Statements and Narrative Instructions that has corrected numbers on it, because these numbers were inaccurate as published in the governor's budget, for which we apologize. So, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair.
Maybe while she's getting ready, I'm just going to take care of some housekeeping items. So, members, next week on Tuesday, we are hearing from Minute, Wednesday, Auditor, and then Thursday, Governor's Office. Did I get them all? So that's what you can expect for overviews. We might have some bills up to next week, so make sure that you can get here on time so we have quorum and we can move that legislation, too.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. And to your presentation, Judge Boost.
Okay, thank you. Is it on the monitors?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. I apologize for that delay. All right. First, I wanted to just take a couple minutes and tell you both who we are and what we do, because I acknowledge that not a lot of people know about the Office of Administrative Hearings. So if you are one that comes to this hearing and has never heard of OAH, you are not unique in that way. So who are we? First of all, we're a court. We are an administrative court. We're made up of 68 dedicated public servants. You'll see the breakdown on the FTE charts that you've been provided by MMB. We've existed as a state agency since 1976. The legislation was passed in 75. We opened our doors on January 1st, 76, and so just last year celebrated our 40th anniversary. Here's what we do. This is what I believe all courts do. We work to ensure that there's fairness and justice, specifically with regard to government actions and inactions. We conduct hearings in a lot of different kinds of things. I'm going to talk to you about four major buckets that we conduct hearings in. One has to do with all workers' compensation hearings in the state are done at OAH. Municipal boundary adjustments, which are cases where property that's located in a township wants to be in the adjoining city or vice versa, wants to be out of the city and in the township, those cases come through OAH. Administrative law cases are cases where a member or a resident in the state of Minnesota believes they've been harmed by an action taken by a state agency or an inaction by a state agency. And in cases where you, the legislature, have given them a right of appeal of those actions, those appeals come to us, and we're the ones who conduct the trials for that. And we also serve as a check and balance on all rulemaking proceedings, and I know that's a topic you're interested in, and we'll get to that as soon as we can. First, as I told you, we're an administrative court. That may not be a term that you've ever heard. So I need to take everyone back a little bit to eighth grade separation of powers. Right, you know that you're the legislature, you pass the laws, you know that the executive branch implements the laws, and you know that the judicial branch enforces the laws. And since I've told you I'm a court, you would think I'm in the judicial branch. I am not. The Office of Administrative Hearings is an administrative court which the legislature created in 1976 and placed in the executive branch. Why? The legislature did that and has kept us going for the last 40 years because you were trying to do two things. One, give residents of Minnesota a very quick and cost-effective way to challenge government action, and two, have an agency that would serve as a check and balance on agency rulemaking. Those are the purposes in the original legislation. We'll talk about that as we continue to go through this presentation. And the benefit that you also had when you created us is you took a lot of cases off the dockets of the judicial branch so that the other cases that remain there, while they take a lot longer than they take at OAH, at least they aren't, at least they don't take as long as they would if they also had the thousands of cases that come through OAH every year. So, we are an administrative court. Here's an overview of our funding. First of all, and it was very interesting for me to sit through Secretary Simon's presentation, and I, too, commend him for the fact that he actually is a contributor to the general fund as opposed to a taker. I, too, am here to tell you that the amount of general fund that we get to support the work at OAH constitutes less than 0.0004% of our overall budget. Why is that? Because two-thirds of our work is the workers' compensation hearings that I talked about real briefly. That is not general fund funded. That is funded through the special workers' comp fund. So all of that money doesn't touch the general fund. The administrative work that we do, the challenges to state agency action, that is not general fund money either. It's an enterprise fund, and I will get into what that means. We have tiny bits of money for the boundary adjustments, $259,000 a year, $50,000 a year for sanitary district boundary adjustments, and the legislature gives us $6,000 a year for the data practices work that we do. And so altogether it's less than $400,000 that comes out of the general fund that supports our overall budget, and our overall budget is $11 million. Let me tell you a little bit about workers' comp. Workers' comp, as you know, involves hearings when somebody alleges that they have suffered an injury that is related to the workplace, and many of those cases don't need to come to hearing, but when they do, we're the court for workers' comp. So all those hearings are held by us. All those cases involve allegations of injured workers, employers that they work for, and the insurers that provide the benefits if, in fact, those are found to be deserved. Again, the funding source is the Workers' Comp Special Fund. That is paid for actually by employers in the state that through a fee-based system pay into that fund. It's not a fund that I see or administer at all. It's simply a fund that pays for the judges that do workers' comp hearings at OAH. It also pays for a lot of what happens at Department of Labor and Industry, which is also a partner agency with us in workers' comp. We have 23 workers' comp judges, and we have 27 administrative staff that support their work. I'm very proud to report that on average, from the time your hearing, your workers' comp hearing ends to the time that you get a written decision, yay or nay, you win, you lose, or what kind of benefits you're entitled to, or employers, what you do not have to pay, and you can close this file, is an average of 38 days. It's all regulated under Chapter 176 if you have any questions about that. Here's a little bit of facts and figures about the volume of work that we do on the workers' comp side. The first number is the one that I think you'll be most impressed by. Over 10,000 dispute documents are filed with our court every year. We set at least half of those for hearings, and you'll notice we've only held 494 hearings. Why is that? That's because in most court systems, most things settle and don't actually go to trial. We have a role to play in that. We have taken an active role in providing mediation services in the workers' comp arena so that we can, again, get people back into the workplace, get employers to have their files closed and know what their the ramifications of injuries are, and everyone can go forward. That's workers' comp. Municipal boundary adjustments. I know that some of you have actually served on the local level. I did as well. I had in a former life, I served on the city council with the city of Roseville, and so I knew a little bit about boundary adjustments before I came to this job. Most of you maybe have never heard about it, but in fact, there's a process where if you are a landowner and you don't like the fact that you're within the boundaries of your township and you want to be in the city, maybe you want city water, maybe you want city sewer, maybe you have some other reason, There are statutory rights that for you to petition to have the boundaries moved so that you can be included in the city. And vice versa as well. If you're on the boundary and you want to be in the township and not in the city, and frankly a lot of that is because townships have different tax levels than cities sometimes do, and so landowners can petition to move. There are statutory criteria that we have to decide in a hearing on whether or not those are met or not and whether the boundary should move. Most of these cases aren't brought by landowners. Most of them are brought either by cities or townships, actually in coordination with each other in trying to figure out future planning of where their boundaries should be and therefore who's going to be providing services to the residents in their area. This is general fund funded. We get $259,000 a year for this work, and there's a $50,000 piece that we get from the environmental fund just for boundary adjustments related to sanitary districts, a whole other kind of little government. We have two administrative staff that do this. It's the same judges that do these cases that do our administrative law cases, so there aren't specific only judges just for MBA cases. And the statute is Minnesota Statute 414, in case anyone's interested in looking at what the criteria are to either annex, detach, or to form or adjust a sanitary district. Here are some maps that show you the breadth of this work across the state. These hearings by statute have to be held in the county where the property is located, so we travel for these cases, and we do them in township board supervisor conference rooms, or we do them in city council chambers, or we do them in other places and communities around the state. That's the second one. So we've talked about workers' comp a little bit. Now we've talked about boundary adjustments. The third one is our administrative law cases, and this is the one that I talked about at the beginning. It was one of the reasons we were formed, which was give the people of Minnesota a way to challenge their government actions that is quick and is cost-effective. We basically provide trials for actions that are challenged involving over 100 different state and local agencies. We do some work for local agencies by contract. It's a really broad scope of kinds of cases. For example, the Board of Nursing might tell a licensed nurse, we're going to take your license because we think you were doing something wrong in the healthcare setting. That nurse statutorily has a right to challenge that action. That trial is held at OAH. Or all special education cases in the state. State law says that if children with special needs are entitled to special education and if families and districts don't agree on what that might be, they have a right to a hearing. Those hearings are held at OAH. Those two are held actually throughout the state. They're held in school districts around the state. If the Public Utilities Commission wants to put a utility line, a transmission line through your neighborhood, or wants to authorize your neighbor to put a new solar garden up. Again, those matters come through OAH. We conduct public hearings throughout the state according to the statutory criteria that you've given us that apply to each and every kind of case. So it's a very broad scope of cases. I have 9.5 judges that do this work. I'm the half. And we have 6.5 administrative staff people that support that work. These cases, after hearing, it takes us about 20 days to get a written decision out, which, again, for those of you who have had any involvement in the district court setting, I think you would be able to agree with me that we are much more efficient than the judicial branch is with regard to the length of time that decisions take. We don't issue final decisions in most cases, and not everyone knows this. In about 90% of the cases, and again, this is statutory, this is what you've decided as the legislature, we listen to the testimony, we swear people in, we put people under oath, we listen to documents, we make decisions, and then we write up findings of fact, conclusions of law, and a recommended order, and those go back to state agencies. Then the agency head has a chance to decide, what do they want to do? Do they want to uphold us, or do they want to flip and say, no, we think that the OAH is wrong? I can tell you that about 98% of the time the commissioners actually decide to do what it is we recommended to do. But the law is that at least in about 90% of our cases, it's not a final decision. There are some of them that are final decisions. For example, sexual predators who've served their time and are going to go out into the community, they get a community notification rating from the Department of Corrections, which says where they can live and who knows if they were a sexual predator. If they get a rating, they get a 1, 2, or 3. If they get a 2 or a 3 and more people are going to know, they have a right to appeal those. Those come to us, we do those hearings, and we are the final decision maker in those cases. All right. Other than that, it looks just like any other court. But how is it paid for? It's not paid for by the general fund. We are an enterprise fund, which means under Minnesota Statute 14.53 and 54, the legislature has said, OAH, figure out what your costs are going to be to do this work. Figure it out ahead of time every year. And then come up with an hourly billable rate and charge the agencies. So basically, for this work, which is about $2.7 million a year, we eat what we kill, which is we decide how much these costs are going to be, how much work we're going to have, how many hours of judicial time that's going to take, how much paper costs, how much travel time is going to be, and we propose to MMB what a reasonable hourly rate should be, and MMB goes through all the financial analysis to make sure that that meets with all accounting standards that it should, and then they approve our billable rate every year. And then that rate is charged to to all the agencies. For example, if the case has to do with a challenge to a child care license, say DHS said there was maltreatment at a child care and they took the license away, and the licensor said, I don't think that happened, I want a hearing. Well, so they have the hearing, we keep track of our time and bill that back to DHS. So, again, in this way, we don't take from the general fund. We don't give anything to it either, I'm sorry to say, unlike Secretary Simon, but we don't take from it. We eat what we kill on this. There are two, again, little pieces of work that we do in this that we get general fund money for. We get $115,000 a year for cases that have to do with allegations of unfair campaign practices because there's no state agency who could pay for them. So the legislature has seen fit to instead say, well, we will pay for those in a different way. And we get $6,000 a year to pay for data practices cases. Those cases are when somebody in Minnesota thinks their state agency won't give them data that they have a right to. They have a right to come to OAH and have a hearing about that. They don't have to just take the agency's word for it. A judge will look at it and look at the Data Practices Act and decide whether or not they're entitled to that data or not. And we get $6,000 a year to do those cases. All right. We've been through three. The last one is rulemaking proceedings. Now, again, back in 1975 when the legislature passed the statute creating us, this was the second reason that they did it. It was because rulemaking was an issue that the legislature was concerned about and wanted to make sure there were appropriate checks and balances in place with regard to state agencies. Let me give you just a little background. Bills. You pass bills. You know your bills become law and they have the force and effect of laws. Courts enforce your bills when they're law. A rule. A rule is defined by your statutes that you've passed as every agency's statement of general applicability and future effect. They're passed by state agencies, and they, too, have the force and effect of the law. Now, the legislature, when Minnesota was first created as a state, there were not executive branch agencies in 1858 when we became state. Didn't exist. In 1925 was when the first time the legislature created executive branch agencies and gave them rulemaking authority. And it was general rulemaking authority with no process, just you have rulemaking authority. In 1939, the legislature decided we need some limits on that, and so they passed some limits and said, well, you can only do what we tell you to do, and it needs to be reasonable. 40 years later, by 1974, the legislature took away all general rulemaking authority and said, you've got to come ask us for authority each time you're going to pass a rule. And we're going to create an Office of Administrative Hearings that will serve to look at each rule proceeding that a state agency initiates and decide, does it in fact follow the rules that we told you to follow? Is it staying within the box that the legislative authority gave you? And is it necessary and reasonable? That's the work we do in rulemaking. So we review every rule that's promulgated to decide, is this necessary? Is this reasonable? Does it stay in the box that the legislature gave the agency? Has there been enough public participation? And I can tell you just last year, we did 35 different rulemaking proceedings, involved 19 agencies. This, too, is funded through the Enterprise Fund, so we keep track of our time. We bill the state agencies. The agencies pay. We don't get any other appropriation for this. We earn the money that we need for it. And in that way, we serve as a check and balance system for the legislature with regard to rulemaking. A few more slides before I can wrap up here. I know you have another presenter after me. things we're most proud about in the last year. We finally got a new website at OAH. I think it was we had the first website ever created, maybe on the planet, but certainly by state at a state agency. And I've only been in this job for 3 years, but frankly, in the first 2.5 before we got the new legislature, I refused to give out the website address because it was really bad. It was very unusable. The public couldn't find anything on it. We have a brand new website that I invite you to go see, and I think you'll be able to find anything you want to know about workers' comp, about administrative hearings, and about boundary adjustment cases, facts and figures, and any background information that you find helpful. The other thing that I'm proud about is for our administrative law division, starting in January of 2016, we started accepting e-filing, which every other court in the state had gone 2 years before, but now we have at OAH, we have e-filing on that side of our office. We still do not have e-filing in workers' comp. And we also made big investments in mediation because we believe that any kind of conflict resolution that keeps people from having to actually go through the cost and expense of a hearing is good for the litigants in a particular case. They think so, too. We've done 140 mediations on our administrative law side. We have a 75% settlement rate. We did about 189 mediations on the workers' comp side. We had about a 70% settlement rate on those. So I think that was an investment well spent of mediation training. We do have a few funding requests, but because we don't come to you for general fund funds, most of them don't involve that. I believe the total of general fund funds that we're asking for is $17,000. And that is, there's an operating adjustment in our budget that has to do with the increased cost of health care that's 9 over the biennium. And the expedited data practices, we need another 12 or 24. I can't it's in the documents before you. If you have any questions about that, we have filed and can get all of you a copy of a data practices report about why the funding system that's set up statutorily does not sufficiently fund those cases. I understand that you may think, well, it's close and it might not be exact, and so take it out of something else. And in most state agencies, that would be a fine response. But because we aren't funded in the general fund, we don't have any other funds to take it out of. We can't use workers' comp, special comp fund monies on data practices cases. We can't use our enterprise fund, eat what you kill money, on data practices cases because that's not part of that same system. And so we've got a small request in to make that balance. But I'm happy to give you more information about that if you need. The other two that are more significant requests have to do with requests related to the workers' comp side of the business out of the special comp fund. One I'm going to highlight for you is the mandated salary increases. In 2015, the legislature passed a statute that increased the salaries of the judges in the judicial branch. It was a 4% over the last biennium. Statutorily, the judges at OAH are paid based on what the district court judges are paid. So we are paid X percent of what a district court judge is paid. That is what the statute says, 15A.083. So when the judiciary got an increase of 4%, we also needed to pay an increase of 4%, and we have. But we didn't get an appropriation out of the special comp fund to cover that, and so instead we've been using salary savings. We don't have any more salary savings. So in this instance, we have a statutory mandate that we have to pay a certain salary level, and we've never gotten the appropriation for it. So that's one of the requests. With that, I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Judge Boos. We've got three member questions, and members, we do have one more presenter. The Attorney General is here. First, to Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just be really brief, and then we'll look forward to meeting with you one-on-one to answer other questions I have. So in the instance that you offered of the special needs family that is challenging what the school district is going to provide for their child, would a hearing like that, do I understand that it would be held in the school district, or is it in your offices? And then I'm assuming that the cost for that hearing would be incurred by the Department of Education. Is that true, or do I have that right?
Judge Judge Boost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, you do have it right that the cost is borne by the Department of Education, and under Minnesota Statute Chapter 125A, hearings on special ed cases have to be held in the school district that the child attends.
Okay.
So they aren't necessarily at our offices unless we're talking about a metro area school district.
Representative Pugh.
Mr. Chair and Judge Poost, and is that hearing public?
Judge Poost.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, that is a parent's choice by federal law. So in each case, a parent has to decide, is this an open or a closed hearing?
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Judge Poost, thank you very much. Wondering, shifting gears, about the instance in which I wasn't clear that you just offered really advice. Your report is advice to an agency 98% of the time. The commissioner accepts that and acts on your advice. What recourse does the public have? I was going to ask what recourse the legislature has. I'm assuming that would be to if the agency would go rogue, you know, and do what they were going to do anyway, irrespective of your advice. The legislature would have to pass new legislation directing the agency, I'm assuming. But in the case of, does the public have any recourse in any way?
Judge Post.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, I will just divide that into two little, I'm going to put a line in the middle. First, we do recommended decisions. When I have my lawyer hat on, I have to say we don't give advisory opinions, so we don't think of it as advice. But I understand what you're saying. It's a recommended decision. A commissioner in 90% of the cases doesn't have to follow it. If the commissioner doesn't follow it, or even if the commissioner does follow it and we're wrong, the party to that case always has a right to an appeal. Appeals from our cases, from final decisions made by commissioners in our cases, go to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. With respect to your other point that what could the legislature do about it, obviously the legislature is the body that wrote the statute that said they recommended decisions as opposed to final. And in some instances, the legislature has said in these categories, OAH decisions are the final decisions, and they don't go back to a commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Poost, how many actual complaints did the Office of Administrative Hearings handle for campaign violations in this last election?
Judge Poost.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I'm sorry, I missed that. Did you say how many cases did we hear?
For campaign violations.
I don't know that off the top of my head. I can get you that information. It goes up and down. In election years, we have more than we do in non-election years. However, the legislature has every year changed the jurisdiction a little bit about which cases come to OAH and which ones go to the campaign board. So we have fewer this year than we had the year before.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
If you could get me a comparison of the last four election cycles, I'd like to see that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I will provide that to the entire committee in case anyone's interested.
Very good. We appreciate that. And lastly, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, what recourse does the legislature have if they determine that the rulemaking exceeds the authority it believes it has given to the executive branch?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the legislature has all control over rulemaking because state agencies don't have any authority to promulgate rules that the legislature hasn't delegated to them. The legislature has set up five or six different, and I actually present on this rulemaking topic at law school for legislators, so I have some of those slides with me that would list out the different kinds of rulemaking that the legislature has already passed. So there's ordinary rulemaking, there's excluded, which means the legislature has said these particular agencies don't ever have to go through rulemaking. There's exempt rulemaking, which is you can do it for 2 years, but then you have to come back and ask us. There's a good cause exemption. If you fit into one of four buckets, you can do it. You can use the good cause exemption. There's expedited. If you, the legislature, tell an agency you can do it faster and you don't have to have a hearing unless 100 people ask as opposed to 25, you can do that as well. And then you can put anything you want in a statute because you're the legislature about a particular rulemaking authority that you give an agency. So the legislature actually has a lot of authority to figure out what rulemaking processes you want the agencies to go through.
Thank you.
Judge Bruce, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely.
I'm sure members will follow up with questions if they have them additionally. Next, we have Attorney General Swanson, if you'd come down.
Thank you, Madam Attorney General. Because we are short on time, if you can maybe condense things down to 10 minutes, because in that way we have 10 minutes still for members to ask questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Happy to, Madam Chair. Let me just jump right in. Thank you for meeting with me and having me here today. You have a difficult job involving the prioritization of two scarce resources, and so I appreciate the opportunity to talk about how our office fits into that. We're a law firm. We're the people's law firm, the public's law firm. And we provide legal representation to over 100 state agency boards, commissions. If an agency wants to file a lawsuit or is sued in court, then we're the entity that provides legal representation to them. And that can really run the gamut from a slip and fall out on the steps because it's too icy and the state didn't do a good enough job putting salt down to major constitutional challenges like the one involving the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Every year we have about 7,000 open legal files, and they run the gamut of issues. The litigation that we're involved in is highly complex and sophisticated. We go up against the biggest law firms in the state and country. And over the years, litigation has been really become much more, what I'd say, knockdown, drag out, contentious in nature, just because of the nature of it. We perform a number of different functions, one of which is to defend the laws that you write. Laws that you write are often challenged constitutionally or statutorily in court, and we're the ones who defend the policy choices that you make. As I mentioned, for example, just to kind of show one type of case, the constitutionality of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program is something that we've been litigating for a couple of years now, and will continue to litigate for probably some time to come. In 1994, you passed a law saying that when a dangerous sex offender has finished his time in prison, yet presents a threat to society, he can be civilly committed to the sex offender program. There are 720 individuals who have been committed as sexually dangerous persons or sexually psychopathic personalities. And, you know, you hear sometimes in the paper the state's sort of just, you know, committing all these people and they're not getting out. The reality is only 4% of registered sex offenders are civilly committed to that program. But who they are is a very dangerous class of individuals. The average number of victims for the people who are committed is 12 known victims per committee. The 10% are diagnosed as sexual sadists. Two-thirds of them have a high degree of psychopathy. 14% killed or tried to kill a victim. Over 40% used a weapon. So it's a very, very dangerous group, and they filed a lawsuit against the state of Minnesota saying both the statute and the way it was administered was unconstitutional. We had a six-week trial. Ultimately, the district court judge ruled against the state. We appealed to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which just in January, with the help of the House of Representatives that filed a friend of the court brief in that case, found that both the statute and the administration of it were constitutional. But now the class of offenders is asking for what's called en banc review, asking the entire Eighth Circuit to review it. And we also face a Phase 2 trial where the offenders are claiming that the conditions of their confinement was unconstitutional because it was more punitive than not. There's also another class action pending called Glidden, where they've sued the state of Minnesota to challenge the constitutionality of that initial commitment process where people are being determined whether they should be committed at all. And then there's about 120 lawsuits filed by committed sex offenders at Moose Lake and St. Peter who want money from the government. They're asking for money ranging from alleged violations of their right to have magazines, to their religious rights, et cetera. And so that's kind of an example of the flavor of some of the things we do. Right now we're defending the legislature in court on a constitutional challenge to the K-12 system, where parents are alleging their children were denied an adequate education. And in December we successfully defended over 140 constitutional challenges to the drunk driving laws that say if you drive drunk, you can have your driver's license revoked. No surprise, people who get it revoked want to challenge that, and so lots of litigation over the constitutionality of those programs. We also protect the taxpayer dollars. You know, in court, when people are looking to sue somebody, they often look for a deep pocket, somebody who's got the ability to pay. And the reality is the state is viewed as a deep pocket. And so it's sued a lot and named as defendants in a lot of cases. And we, you know, believe it's appropriate to aggressively defend those cases to protect taxpayer dollars and not just roll over and fold. Sometimes you'll see stories in the paper of government units doing that where they're sued and they're just sort of handing out money, but, you know, we defend them aggressively to protect the taxpayers. Those are huge, huge cases that involve lots of stakes for taxpayers. There's a case involving some tax compact litigation where a group of corporate taxpayers said that the way in which the Department of Revenue apportioned corporate income taxes was unconstitutional, that Minnesota violated something called the Multi-State Tax Compact. Well, you all repealed that compact in 1987, the key provision of it. The Department of Revenue estimates that in those cases alone, a loss to the state would be over $700 million, to give you a flavor for the magnitude of the dollars. We won before the Supreme Court just recently. It's still being litigated, but we won at the Supreme Court level. I think they were trying to take it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So lots of money is entailed in these cases. Another example, the driver's license cases. There were over 40 cases filed against the state of Minnesota involving state employees looking into the driver's license database. The administration estimated those cases could subject the government to over $250 million in litigation costs. So far, we've won all 40 cases, and we've won all of the appeals that have been adjudicated. So just two cases that I mentioned, over $1 billion we're talking in terms of fiscal impact. We enforce the laws that you write. You just heard from the OAH, a lot of those administrative cases that go to OAH involving agencies. If an agency is there, then we're the ones who are sitting at the courtroom table or representing that agency. And as you heard from OAH, and as you know, those cases really run the gamut of agencies, the gamut of topics. A lot of them, we have the opioid epidemic, of course, going on right now, and it's ripping apart families all over Minnesota. And so we're seeing cases involving opioids, diversion by licensed health practitioners who are in the field where they're around drugs and can divert them or take them, and some pretty tragic cases there that we're litigating. We also provide assistance to rural county attorneys. And we're a big state, and a lot of rural county attorneys, it might be a one-person shop, a two-person shop, and you know, it's not often in some communities that you get homicides, and we can lend an experienced prosecutor who comes into those cases and can help the county attorney. For example, we're helping Wadena County Attorney right now on a case involving an individual who held his wife, 3-year-old son, and brother in law at gunpoint for 2 hours, and as the brother tries to call 911, he shoots him. That county attorney asks for help, and we're up there helping. Lesueur County, there was a son who got mad at the dad, shot him in the head over a supposed argument. We helped Lesueur County try that and got life in prison with no parole. Dodge County, a father and son stabbed an acquaintance that they thought disrespected the family. The Dodge County attorney asked for help. We helped, got life in prison with no possibility of parole and are handling the appeal. Benton County, a tough case involving a civil commitment of a sex offender who violated against 3 teenagers and 3 adult victims, abducting them and taking them to secluded locations and forcibly raping them. And the county attorney said, would you be willing to come in and help commit this individual? And we said, of course, and are doing that. We've contributed substantially to the state's budget balancing efforts over the last 15 years. In 2002, our general fund appropriation was about $26.8 million. Now it's $22.1 million. That's a reduction of 18% in actual dollars and about 52% in inflation-adjusted dollars. And I know we had handed out a letter. I don't know if everybody got a copy in the packets, but I'd refer you to page 4 of the letter just to kind of give you a flavor of how we've managed the resources you give us. The top chart on page 4, the red line shows what we were able to calculate as essentially the growth in state government over those years as a whole, and then the blue line represents, you know, the reduction in spending in our office. So when you match up our office to the rest of state government, we've been, I think, very efficient. And that goes for the personnel count, too. On the bottom of that page, you'll see a chart, some blue bar graphs. In 1998, we had about 535 employees. Now we've got about 335 employees, and we expect people to work very, very hard. The lawyers have busy caseloads, and we demand a lot and expect them to work hard representing the public. And the blue line on the bar graph on the right shows an overall growth in the rest of state government. So as it's going up, we're substantially going down over those years. And now it's our budget's a lot smaller than a lot of county attorney's offices, even though we're the whole state. We represent 87 counties. In fact, our budget's substantially smaller than some of the metro county attorney's offices. If you look at page 5, you'll see our total overall budget when you include federal funding and whatnot compared to the Hennepin County attorney's office budget. We're substantially smaller. That's just one county. We're $13 million smaller. And when you look at our budget, about 80% is personnel costs, about 10% are leases, and then about 10% is everything else that you need to run a law firm, Westlaw, mediation costs, deposition costs, expert witnesses, things of that nature. And so we've been very busy as a litigation shop and have tried to manage these resources you give us very frugally and prudently and in the best interest of Minnesota. And I'll cut it short because I want to leave time for questions. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I just have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
When I'm looking at this, the chargebacks in particular, I'm looking for a delineation for each agency that had a chargeback, both in and out, what the amount was for, and a full description. And we've had some groups that have come forward and have done an excellent job of giving that description. So that's what I'm looking for on that. Also on the FTE counts, too, you've just got listed 2009 and 2016. I'm looking for each year.
Oh, sure.
So we have a comparison on for each year going forward.
Happy to supplement that.
And then just I haven't been able to, dig through all the rest, but I'm sure there's probably, if you can go through the letter again and just make sure that you're hitting every point of question on there, I think that will be helpful for us as we're doing comparisons between each agency and so forth. And then just as a little housekeeping item, Mr. Heller had asked that he's a frequent participant in the legislative process, and this is for all agencies or groups that come before us. He's looking to have all of the, if you do a PowerPoint, if you could forward that on to John. John's going to send out a notice to anybody that comes to testify to have that posted so the public has that available to them so we can put it on our website. But just for those folks that are here today, I wanted to put that out there and recognize Mr. Heller's request as well. So those are just some things that I have. If we can get more details on that, I think that would be really helpful.
Sure.
And then I've got Representative Nash that has a question, too.
Good afternoon, Madam Attorney General.
Good afternoon.
I love your kind of the bullet point of you defend the laws that we write. I think 2 years ago we passed a law that allowed counties to use outside auditors. And I know that there was a lawsuit that included the state, and you naturally would have defended us on that. But I'm curious, if you defend the laws that we write, are you participating in the lawsuits that are currently undergoing against three counties, and if not, why?
We are not. As I understand, Madam Chair, Representative Nash, we are not. As I understand,
Madam Attorney General.
Yeah. As I understand the process, a state auditor filed a lawsuit against three counties, and essentially what you'd have is you'd have the plaintiff and defendant both represented with taxpayer money, and you'd have the taxpayer money representing the state auditor filing a lawsuit, essentially against the state of Minnesota, which then would be paying taxpayer money to defend the lawsuit brought by the auditor. And, the system of jurisprudence we have in the state is that every official county attorney who's sued takes the same oath that I take to uphold and represent and defend the Constitution of the state of Minnesota, and the county attorneys regularly defend laws and defend the constitutionality of laws. And so from the perspective of efficiency for the taxpayer, we didn't think it was efficient to have yet more state resources being put in on both sides of the equation when the county attorneys are able and competent and take the oath to defend those laws.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Attorney General, the other part of my question was, so none of us really liked the whole lawsuit that was lodged against the state, but what happened to get that dropped? So the auditor had initially filed against the state, and somehow that was dropped. Were you an active participant in helping that to get dropped, and what happened?
Madam Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, the state of Minnesota was not a proper defendant to that litigation. You can't just sue the state anytime you want to. You can sue, but you can also get the state dismissed. Had that litigation not been dropped, we would have brought a motion to dismiss the state of Minnesota as a defendant in that case. I was confident we would have prevailed in getting the state of Minnesota dismissed as a defendant in that case. We communicated that to the auditor's office, that we did not believe the state of Minnesota was legally a proper defendant. The state sued a lot, and you know, we try to get the state out of cases when we can, again, to make it more efficient for the taxpayer. And they were not legally a proper defendant under the case law that's available.
Representative Nash.
That's all, Madam Chair.
Members, any other questions at all? Okay. Thank you, Madam Attorney General. Any parting words?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time and consideration.
Great. Thank you. Shoot, forgot. We have to adjourn officially. We are adjourned, guys.